Hello, welcome to Unofficial Partner, the sports business podcast. I'm Richard Gillis. Gary Dodds is founder of the sports marketing agency We Are Fearless. The week before we recorded this interview, me and Sean were at the European Sponsorship Awards and saw Gary and his team win the coveted Agency of the Year award. And so we referenced that in the conversation, along with talking about his previous roles at Octagon and what he thinks is the point of difference between his new agency and the rest of the market, and the universal challenge of creating a distinctive corporate culture. This podcast was recorded a few days before the current lockdown at the company's HQ in London. The Unofficial Partner podcast is now published daily, and we're proud and grateful that our conversations are being listened to by thousands of people from across the sports business every week of the year. If you'd like to inquire about advertising, sponsorship or branded podcasts, please get in touch with Sean via sean@unofficialpartner.co.uk, or you can reach us via the website unofficialpartner.com. So, me and Sean, we're here at We Are Fearless offices in, would you call this Spitalfields? We're with Gary Dodds, we should say that, who's the founder.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you. Is this Spitalfields? Yeah, is this Brick Lane?
It's Spitalfields Market, I'd say.
And how long?
Literally 100 yards away.
How long have you been here?
Been here a year. So we're 5 years old last Monday, so we've been here a year of the five. We were in Covent Garden in the previous four. But this is a more sort of fearless office. Like, it's got a better vibe. It's definitely more of our kind of spirit.
What does that mean?
Well, just, you know, like, when you set an agency up, you need to be different. Like, you need to have a unique point of view. And I think the environment you live in is a massive part of that. You know, like, we had UEFA as one of our clients, and they have got the most fantastic offices. And they came to us and went, these are really good offices. Like, you guys are really, like, this is a good environment. So for us, it's part of that. You know, your environment determines how you think, how psychologically safe you feel coming up with, crazy, brave ideas. So I think, it's important to have a good office.
It's interesting you mentioned, you know, this is a fearless office. So I am going to ask you about this, because I was looking at your website, and there's a lot of sort of that is a motif or a something you're using a lot. It goes, you know, beyond the name. What is it? What do you mean by it in this sense? What is...
Yeah. Well, I guess going back, when I set the agency up, I wanted to solve a problem. There's no point. I was told there's 25,000 agencies out there, and I was thinking, shit. Like, you know, if I just replicate what we've done before, you know, and I was at Octagon 15 years and, you know, good agency, but I can't just repeat that. So you've got to have a point of difference and genuinely stand for something. Like, I really believe you've got to have a point of view on like, society. So for me, the problem was, fear of failure, fear of not being as brave as you should be, not telling your clients what you really feel, not pushing the idea that you really want to back. So to me, like, fear of failure was the issue. And therefore, you know, set up an agency that stands for fearlessness and actually being brave enough to say what you think and do what you mean, and hire people that are a little bit different and stand for your purpose. Like, I think so few people stand for your purpose, and I want to stand for it, and I wanted to put it our name. So it like literally every single day forced us to live it.
And you say hiring people who are fearless. How do you go about doing that? Because one of the questions facing, I think, the marketing industry, but sports marketing industry, is that everyone, I say everyone, lots of people look and sound the same, and there's a very narrow perspective. People, you know, who the definition of creative is very narrow because everyone's got the broadly the same world view. But it's quite difficult to do that, isn't it? To try and find people from outside that bubble.
It is hard. And honestly, you've got to spend a lot of time doing it, because there's no point. If you get the wrong people, then you have nothing. So it's the spark in their eye, it's the energy in their spirit. I always ask them, what's the most fearless thing you've ever done? Like, you want to see some evidence as to what's made them like courageous. And, you know, I remember one of them, and I won't call out his name, but his answer to that question was, oh, I applied to be on Countdown last week. I thought, I love it. I love that spirit that you are willing to put yourself out there. You will be massive out of your comfort zone, but you are doing it because you want to, like, you know, have something about you. We invest in a fearless fund here. So we give money to every single person to go and do something that pushes them outside of their comfort zone. and another guy here is doing stand-up comedy, and he's absolutely bricking it. But well done him for pushing himself out of that comfort zone and thinking, you know what, I'm going to go for it. And if it makes me a better storyteller and slightly funnier in the office and better with my clients, then I'm willing to kind of go for it. So that's really what we mean by being fearless.
And again, but how do you find them? How do you attract those people other than, you know, at the interview? Because you've got, I mean, it's a sort of, my mind went to, there's a debate around government at the moment. Dominic Cummings has made some statements about wanting people. It's the same argument. He wants people from outside Westminster. He doesn't want the traditional. He wants mavericks and weirdos. Yeah. And then they hired one and he was into, sort of, you know, and then they sacked him with
things.
You know, he's into eugenics and, you know, and then they got rid of him. So it's quite difficult to work through what actually that means in practice. I like, you know, I get it and I understand from a client's perspective. Yeah. Oh, okay, we are fearless. I like the sound of that. I want to be brave. Lots of marketing people say they want to be brave and then aren't. I'm just wondering how you go about doing
but you've got to be, I think you've got to be brave in your discipline. Like, there's no point hiring brave people for the sake of bravery. Like, they've got to be a genuine expert in their field. So everyone we hire, whether they are in production, creative, design, partnerships, there's that energy about them. There's that desire to push boundaries and to do things differently. And, you know, they don't have to be like outwardly courageous. They don't need to be into extreme sports or anything silly like that. It's just there's something in it about their personality and their like attitude to life that has that kind of spark. And then you need the backup because, you know, again, you know, one of my concerns was with calling us We Are Fearless was clients might think, well, you're obviously Red Bull's agency, but you're not for us. So for me, fearless is whatever you deem fearless to be, but we always have the backup to our boldness. So the backup is the insights, the data, the human understanding, and that in some ways de-risks any concerns you might have about being too fearless.
Give an example of that.
I mean, one of the things we invest in is a tool called Human Values, and it basically uses, without getting too academic, because I'm not, massively academic, but we are learning, you know, with some great people that support us, that when you look at Maslow's work and Schwartz's work on sort of motivation, understanding why people behave the way they do is absolutely fundamental to the decisions they make. So if you go much deeper and look at the psychology of sports marketing or the psychology of sponsorship and why people behave the way they do, it's so interesting and it allows you to be much braver in your creativity. So it gives us the backup to take more risks.
I love a Maslow hierarchy conversation. So the Sean is struggling with his social needs, so he's fairly lower down. But me and you, Gary,
he's still looking for
No, he's sort of, you know. Anyway, Nick Keller mentioned this the other day about Maslow. It's interesting how often he comes up. He's getting on a bit now, Maslow. Yeah. It was like, sort of 1950s, 60s, wasn't he?
So, yeah, I think 40s. Yeah,
Hertzberg was my personal favourite, but we won't go into the anyway. So you're looking at that. You're using psychology as a way in to try and identify opportunities to use sports marketing in some new way. Is that
so? For me, the one of the greatest insights I think comes out of Havas's Meaningful Brands, where I think they talk about 77% of consumers wouldn't care if brands didn't exist. So for me, that is a massive wake-up call for us as marketeers to think, you know, we need to understand their needs. If they don't think we're relevant, then what hope have we got of creating the right partnership or creating a really interesting piece of content? You've got to understand their needs. So to me, you know, Maslow is just part of it, but truly understanding people's values and motivations for me is the key to great sports and entertainment marketing. Because you go deeper, you go to like what drives their psyche and not just what drives their where they live or what they buy or how old they are or what they earn. Like that is not important. It's why they behave the way they do. And that is driven by your values in life. And they are your kind of psychological drivers. So that's honestly why when I set the agency up, I've always been really interested in people and you know, I did a degree at Loughborough in business and marketing. So I've always been fascinated in that. But it's going deeper and using academia, I think, to be much more intelligent about it. That, for me, is like the secret sauce.
How do you get that information about their inner sort of psyche, in their needs? So if you're using sort of psychological needs as the route in to them rather than demographics? How do you get that information?
I mean, basically, we work with a body of research that's been going for 40 to 50 years. So it's very empirical. It's questionnaire-based. It's using all the kind of scientific questions that allow you to have a more rigorous kind of assessment.
Let's move on to awards. So last week, and this will be a few weeks' time, given you know our when the podcast goes live. But I was sitting at the ESSA Awards, and I thought it was a really interesting moment. You won the Agency of the Year at the ESSA Awards. In front of me was the Octagon table. So you went along and say you picked up your award on stage, and then Octagon had the table right at the front row, and that must have been a sweet moment, wasn't it?
Honestly, I'm one of those people where I try not to gloat because I've got a lot of friends in the industry. I had 15 great years at Octagon. Of course, it was a nice moment to celebrate beating all our peers. And I know the guys at Octagon very well, and I had, 15 great years. So yes, nice moment. I went over and we've exchanged, messages. So, well done them. They've done some brilliant campaigns. And I'll probably talk to one of them later on, which I think is one of the best this year. But no, for us, it's great to be validated. We're 5 years in, we work extremely hard, we've built a brilliant team. I think we have quite a unique purpose and proposition in the market. And then it's just nice to have the evidence that we're doing a great job. And, we're learning, we don't get everything right. But no, it was a nice moment.
What's the difference between being in a big networked sports marketing agency and being an independent boutique?
I think there's a lot of things. Agility, we can basically do what we want and we can move as fast as we need. There's a very small hierarchy here. We're independent. I actually don't have a boss, which is a wonderful...
You are the boss, eh?
I am the boss. So it's a wonderful thing. I have no boss. That's great. So you're much more agile. I think you can take more informed risks. So I don't have a ratio that I have to manage all my staff hires against, although we do run the business biometrics. But, when I was at Octagon, because they're listed on, sort of Wall Street as part of Interpublic, everything you do has to work within the 0.0% staff cost ratio. So you're managed to the nth degree. Here, we're very professional how we manage the business, but we just have a bit more freedom. You can do what you want. You can invest in people and things that you think are interesting and will drive the industry. They're probably the key things.
How does the client notice the difference between, in terms of a network and...
I think, it's horses for courses, isn't it? I think some clients prefer the reassurance probably of bigger network groups. They accept that the rates will be higher. They accept that maybe the ideas won't be quite as brave, but they like the reassurance of just a big, solid, safe kind of network. And obviously, there's some very good agencies within network. So this is not a critique of any network, because there's some outstanding agencies, clearly. But I just think when you're more independent, you often compete against the network. So we have to earn our right against, 1,000-person agencies and networks, and more often than not we'll still beat them on their day, because I guess clients value your value proposition. You'll be better value for money. Arguably you'll be more creative because you have more fearlessness and independence to sort of take the right decisions. You don't have the politics that might prevent you from saying what you think. Sometimes in a network there are politics that mean you can't always give the advice you want to give. Here we just say exactly what we think is the right thing for the client. So I think that's how they see it. And I guess the awards we've won and the clients we've got, proof that, it's working.
What's when you're looking across, who are the clients? Just list a few of your sort of clients.
So we are Bridgestone's Olympics agency across Europe. So we're pretty much their full service agency. Literally this morning, if I can plug some work we're doing. So we launched Bridgestone's Olympic brand campaign in South Africa. It's the seventh market that we've gone live in. Caster Semenya was one of the athletes that we've been working with, and our work with her and the other two athletes will be on air literally tomorrow on the four main South African broadcast channels. So we've become an advertising agency, which is fantastic, but being, specialists within sport and entertainment.
Why did you go with her?
So
the face of it,
the campaign is chase your dream no matter what, and the whole point of the campaign is that it's there to inspire people in life to have a dream and to keep on chasing it despite all the ups and downs of life. And it mirrors the role that our tire plays, that's, you know, always there with you on every journey in life, and, you know, the good and the bad journeys in life. So we wanted to identify athletes that embodied that no matter what spirit, you know, that desire to always push past the challenges that all of us face in life. So it's a very purpose-driven campaign, and Caster obviously has such a brilliant backstory and upbringing and a wonderful energy to her.
What's she like working with?
Well, Sally, I have not personally met her, but the team who went out to film with her, you can see her confidence. She has this amazing magnetism and inner sense of confidence and achievement and resilience. So, I mean, she's wonderful. And obviously, you know, she's so iconic in everything that happens around her and all her performances that she's been an amazing asset.
When you look across the sort of what clients want when they get into sport, there is a sort of, we're at this odd moment where you've got a lot of the rights holders have their own creative teams, and they are beginning to look a bit like agencies in some ways. Man United has got its own creative director, and you've got, you know, others are doing the same. What's the future for agencies? Are they just going to be subsumed? Is that market just getting smaller in terms of the work that's there? How do you manage that process? Because you've got people on the media side, you've got people like Copper, who are, again, looking a bit like an agency, but with a media sort of entity attached. So it's a very dynamic, changing marketplace. How do you see it? How do you view it?
I mean, to me, it's fascinating, because I don't think, honestly, it's too easy to in-house creativity, because I think creativity is based on diversity of thought, and diversity of thought comes from the different clients you work on, comes from the variety of nationalities and cultures that you have in an agency. So honestly, I really don't believe you can in-house creativity and be this world-class, brave, courageous kind of creative team. I really don't. Now, maybe Man United have their own singular proposition, so maybe, you know, they're very, very good at talking to that proposition. But, you know, as an agency, we need to be experts in confectionery or recruitment or tires or football. So you need diversity of thought. I think the outcome for agencies is still very rosy. I think the ones that are not brave and willing to give their honest point of view, I think, will die. You know, I mean, clients want you to solve a problem. If you're not going to give an honest answer, then you have no chance. So I think there'll be massive consolidation. I think there'll be new dynamic players coming in. You're right. I think in-housing will probably take more of a media programmatic basis. Maybe comms might go in-house. But I still think fundamentally creativity is an art that needs to be nurtured and looked after. And I think the best environments are those agencies that really kind of respect that.
Always with the issue with creative is discoverability, isn't it? Trying to, you know, I'm always struck when I either judge awards or I go to awards sort of dues, where people are getting gongs for, and that's the first time I've seen them, or I didn't know them. And it was, I always think that's a bit odd. Surely they should be famous out there in the world. And I realise that obviously it might not be my target market, and this is a whole thing that's going on outside of my filter bubble. But is that the key challenge at the moment? Trying to, you can have a great idea, but no one sees it, or not enough people see it.
Honestly, for me, we're problem solvers. So for me, you've got to solve the right problem with the right audience at the right time. So I don't think it matters if we don't all see every campaign, because maybe that campaign, as you say, wasn't right for you, or actually the investment didn't mean that they wanted to reach you at that time. So I think as long as we're solving the right problems and you can evidence the success and impact, and clients are happy that you know, you've done it in an honourable way and you've been courageous in the way you've gone about it, I don't think it matters if every campaign doesn't have that huge fame. Obviously, the way the world is moving now is we're becoming more into an earned media kind of landscape. So you want to generate its own fame and its own kind of virality. So it is important to have a campaign that will be shared and talked about within the community that the client cares about. And I think this industry has not got there yet. You know, there's very few ideas, I think, that have really created that, you know, lit that fire and really kind of created that sort of contagion. And I think that is a really interesting opportunity going forward.
What are the ones that you that stand out over the last few years from a here's an idea and here's one that blew up, you know, that
I mean I became I, famous. I mean I like campaigns that really touch your heart, because I think you're much more likely to care if you're emotionally engaged. So I've loved, you know, the sort of Paddy Power work this year. Well done, Octagon. I think that was brave because, there's a bit of a contradiction in terms here, because obviously it's a sponsorship campaign, but actually in some ways it's about saving the shirt, and it's about, you know, kind of honouring the uniqueness of what that can provide. So I enjoyed the tension inherent in that campaign, and obviously Paddy Power invest in very brave comms, and they'll always pick ideas that have a real sense of kind of bravery at their heart. So I've really enjoyed that. I love campaigns that have a real sense of purpose. I think purpose is so key to marketing now. Like, you know, 77% of consumers don't really care about brands. You've got to make them care. You've got to like understand their needs. So campaigns that have genuine sense of purpose and are trying to change society and trying to be a force for good, I naturally kind of gravitate to them. So the whole Kaepernick, Nike, Just Do It, they're fantastic. Like they really touch me, and I think touch society, and they light a fire, and they're controversial, and they're provocative. But they're provocative because they stand for something powerful, which is great. People may or may not buy into that, but at least it stimulates a conversation and gets people kind of talking about it.
So you think that the brand purpose is real? People care what brands stand for, as well as the service that their product,
I think people care about causes. And I think if a brand has an authentic role to play in that cause and they're trying to add value to that cause, then I think by association, consumers will start to care more about the brand. But I don't think inherently people wake up in the morning and, you know, massively love brands. Like, there's just so much evidence to suggest that's not the case, which is why you've really got to understand people's instinctive needs so that you can actually add value to their life. And that's, you know, that's why sponsorship and partnerships has such a power to play. You know, I remember, you know, Frank Lowe, you know, created the Octagon brand, you know, X years ago, and it was all based on that insight that the world will disintermediate with media. You know, you cannot rely upon a model that is pushing content out and hoping people do what you say. People will need to be engaged and you know, move to a pull model. And what's more powerful than, you know, the things that, you know, spur your heart, that, you know, make you kind of really get your heart beating faster. So he's a real vision, you know, all those sort of 20, 25 years ago. And I think, you know, even now, marketers haven't really fully embraced the power of passion. And I think there's such an exciting future for all of us.
In terms of your rosy then on the future of sponsorship, because obviously there are, you know, there is this argument that actually, if I'm a brand and I want to make a noise and associate with football, I don't need to go the sponsorship route in the same way. And actually, all of the restrictions that are imposed on me and all the category exclusivities and all of the sort of problems that come with that are just too much effort, and I might as well just do it myself. And, mm-hmm. you know, a great idea is a great idea. I don't need to buy the rights. Is that, but you're quite bullish on...
No, honestly, I'm bullish on great ideas. That has to be the cornerstone. If it solves the problem, then the idea is the sacrosanct platform. Whether you then choose to create that idea through a partnership, you know, like the Lego movie, I still think that's one of the best, you know, partnerships ever. You know, and it is a partnership. It's not really a sponsorship, it's a partnership. You know, they worked with a studio, they created some IP, they created a creative idea, they then monetized it and distributed it through, you know, various kind of channels. But it originated in the problem Lego had and the partnership delivered the IP and the creative platform that then solved that problem. So I'm much more of an advocate of strategic partnerships. I actually don't personally, and maybe I shouldn't say this, but I don't really like the word sponsorship. I feel like it has a bit of an old, tainted kind of perception. I don't think that's true. I think there are some very, very good sponsorship campaigns, and I think there's some very, very good sponsorship agencies and sponsors. But I prefer strategic partnerships is probably the way to explain things.
Why? What's the...
I just think strategic partnerships is you can create your own partnership, you can buy off the shelf. It may not even be a partnership that anyone can foresee, but you actually, with your imagination, you can go create it from scratch. So I think strategic partnerships is just a much better definition of this sort of imaginative, creative world that we live in, where intellectual property will create the right kind of idea for you.
Do you think that out there in the real world, people notice the difference between these things in terms of, you know, as in sponsorship is something people understand, and actually there is a, you know, that in its initial form, there is a benevolence to it, there's a generosity to a sponsorship relationship, which, and a partnership can often feel very transactional, can feel very exploitative in the wrong sort of hands. Is that, do you not see, I know what you mean, I've heard the partnership argument, but I actually think I'm going back towards sponsorship.
Yeah. Are you? Okay. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Look, sponsorship has a lot of benefit, and you're absolutely right. If audiences understand the value you're bringing and the fact that your investment is making something happen that would not happen anyway, then yeah, that's a huge story to tell, and it should be a huge benefit. I think most consumers are quite simple animals, and I think you have to kind of understand that you don't have very long to engage them. You know, you've got the sort of 3-second scroll kind of, you know, in social, so you really don't have very long to engage them. So honestly, for me, as long as you're solving the problem in a way that a client like understands and agrees with, and a consumer cares about, so it actually, you know, stirs their heart, I don't think it matters whether it is a sponsorship or it is a partnership. Each comes with its own benefits, and therefore you've got to decide what benefits outweigh each other. And you're right, maybe for some brands who've had a tough time, and maybe they've got a perception that's quite negative, maybe the more formal sponsorship, image transference, the generosity that you talk about, maybe that's something that will be more important for them. But I don't think, for me, as a hard and fast rule, I would always pick sponsorship over partnerships. Honestly, I think it's about solving the problem.
Okay, let's talk about failure for a moment. And I'm always interested in entrepreneurs and, you know, startups. And this isn't a startup, but it obviously started up at some point 5 years ago. What mistakes did you make, or have you made, that you look back on?
Failure is an interesting word, isn't it? Because, I mean, all of us hate losing anything. Like, fear of loss, I think, is like such a huge thing in people's lives. And I always try and learn from my failures. Like, I'm very much one of those people that I don't mind if I make mistakes. Like, I really don't, because life is a journey, and as long as you learn from them and you try not to make them again, then that's fine. So, I mean, I've made mistakes. If I can go back to my time at Mars, when I won the Mars Sales Achievement of the Year. I got to meet John Mars, who was this fascinating, you know, kind of like...
It doesn't sound like a failure story.
No, I am coming on to it. No, I really am going to answer your question. But fascinating, like eccentric. And I won it because I won a sales award. And I thought, right, my career's got to be in sales and grocery and national accounts. And I went for Mars's promotional panel. And I failed, like I failed dismally, and I did a really, you know, shitty job in it. Because ultimately, I'm much more of a creative, strategic brain than I was a more financially driven, kind of sales driving, like, you know, kind of grocer. So I learned in that moment that don't go for what you are not best set on. Like, stick to your strengths, stick to what you care about, stick to what your ambitions in life are. So that failure, like, spurred me on massively, because, you know, no one wants to fail. And I guess coming back to the agency here, I mean, we've lost pitches where maybe we think, you know, why did we not go with that insight over that other insight? Like the client gave us a bit of a bum steer and we took the bum steer. We didn't stick to our guns because that actually idea would have won us the pitch. I've had some people where maybe they were not quite the right fit here. They didn't bring the sort of fearless mindset that we want. I think sometimes you can be a bit too unfocused. And, you know, we get asked to pitch quite a bit. And it's, you know, it's great to hear that X brand or X client wants to for us to kind of work with them. And you might go for more pitches than you actually can sustain. So, there's mistakes around focus and, and sticking to your guns, I guess.
Well, so the pitching process, I always find... It struck me as someone, I was a journalist and then worked for an agency, and it was Havas, so, and this meaningful brands thing was very central to it. The pitching process I found extraordinarily wasteful. What? How do you manage that? Because it just felt like, okay, I don't know if you need a separate business within the business just to deal with pitches, because they're just relentless, and you're up, you know, sometimes up against multiple competitors, and it just felt like this is a waste of time. But it's really hard to say no to a pitch, isn't it? What do you think of the pitch process? Is it sustainable?
I mean, honestly, it's one of my biggest bugbears, because, you know, you want to devote your energy in the right places, and fair enough, if there are clients that genuinely want you to come and work for them, then run a pitch of three agencies, give them a simple brief, give them, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, and be true to that process. Whereas honestly, I see pitches where there are 15 agencies pitching. There are briefs that aren't really briefs. There are processes where you're not really allowed to ask questions. So you're kind of slightly hunting in the dark for this mythical brief with a client you don't really understand, because they haven't given you the input to be like truly smart about the response. So it is quite a challenge. Having said that, there are some clients who run great pitches and they're very honourable, and you can look them in the eye, and it's an honest process, and then you've got to give your best. I would like to move to a position where we don't we don't give away our creative. Like, fair enough, test us on our chemistry and test us on a point of view, but don't ask us to give you the answer, because that's more and more what I'm seeing now. They literally want the answer and the timings and the detailed budget and the different scenarios of, if that idea is not right, what else could be right? And I think that's a bit unfair. And we try and push back where we can. I think we'll push back harder in the coming years.
What do you think, what's your position on brainstorms in terms of just going into the creative process? How do you do it? Are you small groups, go off and come back, or are you 15 people in a room, no bad ideas, except that one?
We run quite a smart process. So we're very insight led. So we don't run any process until we understand the true problem and qualify the problem with the client. Because sometimes their brief will, they think the problem is X, but actually the problem is Y. So start with the right problem and then build up your insight base. You know, look at psychology, look at neuroscience, look at other cultural trends. And only then have you got that really interesting insight base and the truths. Do you start to go through the creative process? We don't do mass brainstorms where it's hit and hope. They're much more structured. We invite different people with diverse thoughts and backgrounds. We have our finance team involved in processes sometimes, because culturally they're so connected. Why wouldn't they be part of a pitch process? But it's quite structured. We diverge and then converge. So we try and think very broadly about what the right possibilities could be, try not to judge them too much up front. And then you start, as you go back through the process, you know, do they feed off the right insight? Do they solve the problem? Do they excite us? Do they slightly scare us? Like, I think there's an element of, and I can think of pitches where, you know, there's been some ideas we've gone, holy shit, like that's quite a scary idea, but that is the right idea. We've got to pitch it. And you need that energy. If you don't have that energy, then you haven't got a winning pitch.
And just to round us off, where are you going? What's the plan? You're 5 years old. I've seen the models. Talk about the clay. What was that all about?
Well, look, we were 5 years old last Monday. And as part of our celebration, we wanted everyone to define what fearless meant to them. So we gave everyone some clay And over breakfast, they fashioned whatever they deemed fearless to be. I'll show you when I go out, but I built a clay model of a very tall person and lots of other smaller people around. And it was all about like, stand tall, stand up for what you believe in. Don't let others kind of shout you down. Be honest to what you think, you know, the clients, you know, you need to tell the clients. Other people built some really interesting, far more creative versions of what I could do. It was great. Like, it's just doing things a little differently, isn't it?
And where are you going? What's going to happen in the next 5 years?
So to me, I think we've built a really distinctive offering. We just need to get better at everything. Like, you know, improve our creative, improve our ratio of pitch wins, build our client base, you know, get more academic evidence into how we think, get smarter on our measurements. You know, the grand plan, maybe in the future, might be to sell. But, you know, in many ways, that's so far off. I just want us to be genuinely the best agency in our field. And, you know, it was nice winning the ESSA award for best agency in Europe. But, you know, awards are awards. Like, it's the work, it's the clients. That feeds the revenue. It makes sure you can hire the great people. So I think keep on doing what we're doing, but just keep improving each day and hire people that like really inspire you and work that really, you know, motivates you every single day of the year to be the best you can be.
Okay, Gary Dodds from We Are Fearless. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.